he gave these broad moral principles, such as you should not kill, you should love your God with all your mind, your heart, and your soul. You should not commit adultery and so on. And you should stop work every 7 days. Now, the ruling class didn't have to stop work every 7 days. They didn't work anyway, right? So in this way, he gave at least 1/7 freedom to the slaves, you know. Now, if Moses had said, well, it would be a good idea if from time to time you stop work, well, how long would that have lasted, you know? But he made then the Sabbath, the stopping work every 7 days, complete cessation of work, a fundamental, one of the 10 commandments, one of the fundamental commandments of his moral system. And there is in the Bible the story of the fact that two men broke the Sabbath, and they were brought before Moses, and they said, we found these men working on the Sabbath. So he said, what should we do with them? So Moses said, stone them to death. When they were taken out, and they were stoned to death. They didn't break the Sabbath after that, okay? But he made it clear, this is a moral principle just as important as these other moral principles, okay? So, but Moses did not abolish slavery. Now, this is a subject of debate, and I'm certainly not going to get into it, but you can think about it yourself. I mean, one can debate, would it have been possible to abolish slavery, or was slavery a necessary component to the rise of higher forms of civilization? In other words, in the transition from tribal societies, which were based on purely local reciprocal relationships, to the city-states and the higher societies, was the creation of slavery or the implementation of slavery essential? This is a philosophical question that one could debate. I have my own opinions about it, which is that it wasn't. But the fact is that it was the means. It was the means that mankind effectively employed, and it is also a fact that none of the prophets ever abolished it. Neither did Jesus. I mean, we know the letter of Philemon, where Paul sends Onesimus, an escaped Christian slave, back to his Christian master. And he says, you should accept him as a brother. But this brotherhood was a spiritual brotherhood. It was absolutely clear that he was going back as a slave, Christian slave to his Christian master. So Christian brotherhood was a spiritual relationship which did not imply any change in social status. And, you know, this is also the statement of Paul where he says that if one should maintain one's condition, that becoming a believer in Jesus did not change one condition. If one was a slave, one should remain a slave. If one was a master, one should remain a master, and so on and so on. So it's quite clear that the Christian notion of brotherhood, as understood in any case, by the followers of Jesus, did not imply any change in social condition. So I don't want to go on about this, but the point is then that slavery is pervasive. It pervades our history, and certainly there could be no greater, you know, evident example of injustice than slavery, okay? I mean, why should this segment have to limit its freedom and so on in favor of this other segment of society? I mean, there's absolutely no justice in this. So it is unjust, and it is pervasive. But, of course, that's only the beginning of the story. I mean, every conceivable type of human relationship is impregnated with injustice. The relationship between man and woman, right? Man is more powerful than woman, so he dominated woman. End of story. I mean, that's what Abdu'l-Bahá says, and that's what we see, okay? He could do it, so he did it. and all the other stories of conquest, of dominance, racial prejudices, religious prejudice, believer against unbeliever, and so on and so on and so on. So our history is a history of injustice. Now the next question is, what is the source of this injustice? Why is our history a history of injustice? Because if we want our future to be different from the past, if we want to establish justice, then we will have to change something, right? I mean, nothing is surer than the fact that if we behave in the future the way we've behaved in the past, our future will be like our past. That's logic. Okay? Everybody agree with that? If we behave in the future the way we've behaved in our past, if we don't change our behavior, then our future will be like our past. And our past has been a history of pervasive, all-impregnating injustice. Yes. 5 minutes, well, you'll have to make another because we're going to one, right?
We're
going
to go to 12:30, but we can go to...
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I thought it was one. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you want to go to...
What time did we start? 11?
Yeah.
11:30. Yeah. Okay, we were just doing the 1 hour thing. Okay.
Go for 10 more minutes. Go to a quarter to. Is that alright?
Well, what? Maybe people are tired. I don't know.
Go to one.
The kitchen. The people who were working on lunch were the ones who informed us that we were breaking. That we were working till one. That's where we got that idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Jace brought in a company.
Well, let's just finish this subject. We got this part.
You want to know how it ends?
We don't want to
interrupt
your life.
It'd be so unjust to stop.
Let's go to 1 o'clock.
Okay. Well, we'll evaluate in a quarter to. All right, and we can see where we are.
We're flexible.
Okay. Okay. So our history is a history of injustice. The question then is, as I say, what is the cause of this injustice? We have to identify that, because if we don't identify the cause and remove the cause, then our future is going to be like our past. Now Baha'u'llah says, what is the central institution of the Baha'i faith? The House of Justice. Baha'u'llah says that he's come to establish justice, to bring about justice in the world. So the very purpose of the Baha'i revelation is to change this history, to change the whole of history. So we had bloody well begin to figure out what it is that has caused this injustice. If we're going to go around, and especially if we claim to be the instruments of Baha'u'llah to remove it, then we better find out what it is that has caused it so we can be sure that we're not causing further injustice, right? Well, Baha'u'llah gives us the answer. The root cause of injustice. Is the pursuit of power. Not the exercise of power, the pursuit of power. Not the holding of power, but the attempt to increase one's power. It is the pursuit of power that is the cause of injustice. Well, let's read one passage where Baha'u'llah says this. There are many, actually, where he says this. But let's read one of them. I have to think where this is, but I will get it fairly quickly. Let's see. It's in two places. Okay, here it is on page 239, which is in the concept of spirituality, but it's also in the causality principle essay. Later on after lunch, I will take a few minutes and explain to you a bit the structure of the book so you can understand where to find certain ideas. You know, this is quoted in one of the compilations. It's from Baha'u'llah. It says, "And amongst the realms of unity is the unity of rank and station. It redoundeth to the exaltation of the cause, glorifying it among all peoples." Now listen to this. "Ever since the seeking of preference and distinction came into play, the world hath been laid waste. It hath become desolate." That pretty well describes Bosnia, doesn't it? And Northern Ireland and the Middle East and every place else, right? "Those who have quaffed from the ocean of divine utterance and fixed their gaze upon the rim of glory should regard themselves as being on the same level as the others and in the same station. Were this matter to be definitely established and conclusively demonstrated through the power and might of God, the world would become as the Abha paradise." Well, the Abha paradise is certainly a place where justice prevails and where injustice is eliminated. "So the source of the elimination of injustice is the renunciation of the pursuit of power. Indeed, man is noble inasmuch as each is a repository of the sign of God." So Baha'u'llah, we are all different. Each of us has a different dominant attribute. Each of us has different capacities. "Nevertheless, to regard oneself as superior in knowledge, learning or virtue, or to exalt oneself, or to seek preference, to pursue preference, is a grievous transgression. Great is the blessedness of those who are adorned with the ornament of this unity and have been graciously confirmed by God." Pretty clear, all right? And there are other passages, but that will do for the moment. So the Baha'i writings tell us that the root cause of injustice is the pursuit of power. We pursue power. Now, why do we pursue power? Well, because we start out life as weak and vulnerable creatures, in which other people, our parents, have power over us, a virtually absolute power. They have power of life and death over us when we were children. And so as we grow and develop, we become more autonomous. We have more power. And so we see that when we have power, we can force people to do things. We can control our environment to some extent as we have power. Or at least we have the illusion of being able to control it. Well, we really can control our immediate environment to some extent. So we say, okay, the more I can control my immediate environment, the more power I have, the less vulnerable I am, the less threatened I am, and the happier I will therefore be. So the man loves his wife, but he regards his wife as his possession. And so, since he's physically stronger than his wife, since he does in fact have the power to limit his wife's freedom, he does so. Because this, he thinks, increases his happiness, because it assures him that this possession, which is his wife, will remain in his possession, that she won't sleep with somebody else, or she will not fall in love with somebody else, or she won't leave him, or whatever, whatever. Remember that the man has the threat of physical dominance over the woman, But the woman carries the even greater threat of the rejection of the man, which is the one thing that no man can tolerate, to be rejected by a woman. Okay? This is the ultimate disaster for any man, to be rejected by a woman that he truly, whose approval he truly desires. Because it recalls this possibility of rejection by the mother, I mean, which is his death, literally. I mean, if the child is rejected by his mother, then he dies. I mean, that's it. This is life and death. So the greatest, the visceral fear, the ultimate fear of any man is rejection by the mother and by any mother substitute. So this is the power game that has gone on for all of history between the man and the woman. The man who tries to use his physical power to make it impossible for the woman to reject him. If she doesn't move in society, if she stays in the home, if she's constantly pregnant, if she's constantly involved with the children and so on, serving the man, then she has no possibility of rejecting. How can she reject him? She can't go off, there's no place to go to, and so on and so on and so on. So the man is creating conditions which make it impossible for the wife to reject him, if she would choose to do so. I mean, it doesn't mean that she would. So why is Baha'i marriage having such a problem? Well, because now that we're trying to establish a reciprocal relationship between man and woman, then this gives both partners choices that they didn't have before, and they can misuse this freedom. And so now women can reject men, and so they do so. I mean, a lot of them do. And so men now have the experience of enduring this rejection and having to deal with it. Now, some of us who are men may say, well, this is unfair. I mean, the woman shouldn't reject. Well, you know, that's right. We inherit a history of injustice. What does that mean, that we inherit a history of injustice? It means we've learned how to be unjust. Okay? We have the knowledge of how to be unjust, and we don't know how to be just. We haven't learned how yet. That's what we're doing. That's what the Baha'i Faith is. So it's only 100 years since Baha'u'llah has come that we have begun the process of learning how to be just with each other. So is it any wonder that as soon as we get the freedom to choose, that we choose wrongly in lots of cases? You know, so... So the men are whining, look, we're being treated unjustly. That's right, you're being treated unjustly. That's what it feels like. Now you understand. Yeah, that's right. That's what it means to be treated unjustly, right? Yeah, now you got it. Now we can begin to work on the problem, okay? Now, I'm not saying, you know, that I'm not giving any license to women to treat their husbands unjustly. If you treat somebody unjustly, you will suffer. You will suffer the spiritual damage of doing this. Okay, so the root cause of injustice is the pursuit of power. Now, power is an illusion. Power is an illusion. Why is power an illusion? Because we've just said that power does give you the ability to control your immediate environment. Power is an illusion because the one thing that power cannot control is love. You see, power controls by inflicting pain and suffering, by giving negative consequences to certain acts. There's a story of one of the Russian czars who told his minister, go out and make the people love me. You see, that's the one thing you can't do. Now, the writings tell us that love is the only source of happiness. When we read this yesterday, this is the little opening quote in our book, right? Know thou of a certainty that love is the secret of God's holy dispensation, the manifestations of the all-merciful. Love is heaven's kindly light. Love is the cause of God's revelation. Love is the one means, the only means, that ensureth true felicity, true happiness, both in this world and the next. So everybody wants to be happy, but the only way to be happy is by giving and receiving love. This is the only thing that makes us happy. Nothing else will make us happy. Love is the one means, this is Adwa, it's not me, is the only means that ensureth true felicity both in this world and the next. It's the only way to be happy is in the giving and receiving of authentic love. Now, power then cannot produce love. Power can potentially produce anything. It can produce knowledge, science, everything else, but it cannot produce love. Love cannot be commanded. The easiest way to see this is think of the person that you find the most unlovable and will yourself to love them. You'll see that you can't do it. You can't make yourself love anybody. Love cannot be commanded. So power is powerless over love. So what does this tell us? That love is the most powerful thing that exists. Because it is the only thing that pure power cannot obtain. Since love is the one means of achieving happiness, then what we should be pursuing is love. So, what man has in fact done is make power an end. He has pursued power, which has created injustice and cruelty or hatred, and generated cruelty and hatred. Because the result of injustice is that we don't like people who perpetrate injustice. You know, we resent it. So the pursuit of power leads to injustice, the opposite of justice, and hatred. Now, what is justice? Well, we can define justice in all sorts of ways. But here is my favorite definition of justice. Justice is simply the essential condition for the flourishing of love. The purpose, justice is not an end in itself either. The end is love. Justice is the means to attaining love. So, man through history has pursued power. When you pursue an end, you use a means, right? In other words, in order to get something, you have to sacrifice something. This is the law of the world, right? So what do you sacrifice to get power? You sacrifice justice and you sacrifice love. What does the North American businessman sacrifice to get success? He sacrifices his family and his kids and everything else, if he has to get success. Ask the average North American, what is the purpose of life? What will most people say? To be successful, right? I mean, success is, what is the most important thing in your life? Well, it's to be successful. Or the worst thing in North America is to be considered not a success, right? To be not successful. Ask a Russian, what is the most important thing in his life? And he will say, love, human relations. If you ask a Russian, what about success? He will immediately say, what do you mean by success? What is success? Ask a North American, you say success is the most important thing in your life. What is success? You don't know what success is? He takes it for granted that it's obvious what success is. Success is dying with the most money. Success is being considered a success by whatever criterion is currently the criterion, right? That's what it is. Being considered a success is having status in terms of whatever are the criteria of success in your reference group. It's being a world-class mathematician if you're a mathematician or whatever you want. But it's being a success means being considered a success by other people. So in pursuing success, one pursues power. And in pursuing power, one sacrifices justice. How do you obtain power? Well, by being willing to compromise your principles if you have to. By sabotaging the performance of other people with whom you're in competition. Okay? And what does this do? Well, injustice creates hatred. It creates resentment. I mean, take the most successful people in any area of endeavor. Are they the most loved people? Very rarely, right? Very rarely. Because they've climbed over a lot of bodies to get to the pinnacle of success. So what Baha'u'llah is telling us, that we have to reverse this. We have to reverse this pyramid, and we have to pursue love. We pursue love by using our power to create justice. Justice is the conditions under which love can flourish. So you see, the fault in the thinking of the pacifists is that we renounce power. Baha'is do not renounce power. What is more powerful and authoritative than the universal house of justice? Infallible. Obedience to them is obedience to God. I mean, that's power, okay? We don't renounce power, but we do not pursue power. We use power to establish justice. And what is justice? Justice is a reciprocal relationship of giving and receiving, which allows love to be born and flourish. So in other words, power cannot command love. You cannot move from power to love. Love has to be invited. Love comes, love is a gift. Love is grace. There you talk about grace. That is. Okay, I got it. Love comes from God. Love is God. Love is God. All love comes from God. It is that mystic feeling which unites God with man. All love comes from God. We cannot create love. We cannot generate love. We are like that basket immersed in the ocean. But we can use the power we have, the degree of autonomy developed, to create justice. That we can do. And once we create justice, then God gives us the gift of love, because we have created the conditions under which love can be born or flourish. So this is what we're about. We're about reversing 6,000 years of history. We are reversing this unhealthy process, and where we pursue power and sacrifice justice and love in the pursuit of power, and we're turning it around, and we're going to pursue love by using power, not pursuing power, but using power. Remember, I said the Baha'i Faith is the most powerful thing in the world, but that we have access to this power only on certain conditions. So inasmuch as we fulfill these conditions, we will be given this power. We use this power to establish justice, and the result is that love is born and flourishes, and as love is born and flourishes, we are happy. I mean, it's just, we're happy. Everybody's happy because it is happiness to love and it is happiness to be loved, both of them. So let me conclude then by saying this. In other words, in order to achieve authenticity, we must deliberately, consciously renounce the pursuit of power in all of our relationships. We must renounce the pursuit of power. After lunch, I'll talk about this in relation to the Baha'i institutions. We look at our National Assembly as powerful people elected like politicians who are pursuing power, and therefore we don't love them. We say, you've already got the power. You want love as well? You want respect? It's easy to love somebody who's down, right? It's easy to love somebody who is sick and so on. Can you love a member of the House of Justice? Can you love a counselor who has a higher rank than you do? Do you think of his higher rank as meaning that he has power over you, that he has pursued power? Or does it mean rather that he is serving, and therefore you should love him or her and be thankful for his service? You see, that's the test of renouncing the pursuit of power. As Abdu'l-Bahá himself has said, Jesus already said it 2,000 years ago, anybody can love a lovable person. Even the pagans do that, Jesus said. Even the mafia. I mean, you take the worst person on earth. He will love a lovable person. A lovable person evokes love. There's no virtue in loving the lovable. The virtue is in loving the unlovable. And the virtue is in loving those whom we perceive as having power over us, because we renounce the pursuit of power. We have to renounce the pursuit of power. So, again, the choice is yours. You say, I don't like this. These people, the NSA members and so on, sometimes they act just like politicians or whatever. And so I'm not going to love them. Fine, don't. Don't. It's only going to hurt yourself, because you have not learned to renounce the pursuit of power. You're in a power struggle with these people, okay? And believe me, I've seen it all over the world. This is what's going on everywhere. Power struggles in the faith, okay? So the only way out is we have to renounce the pursuit of power. That's what it's all about. Take a few minutes, since a number of you have this book, just to indicate some of the sort of the structure of the book. Maybe we can look at the table of contents on page VII. The earliest essay that is in there is the last one, The Concept of Spirituality, which is an integral reprint of a short monograph that appeared about 10 or so years ago with the Association for Baha'i Studies. Some of you may have seen that little maroon-colored monograph called The Concept of Spirituality. It was also reprinted integrally in the Baha'i World, in one edition of the Baha'i World, and it's reprinted here. There are no changes in any of these reprints. They're all identically the same. This has many of the ideas that I've talked about, and some that I'm going to talk about further today, about the development of spiritual capacity, knowledge, love, and will, and so on. It's sort of on a more practical level, if you might say. The essay that represents more recent thinking or understanding is the one called the Kitab-i Ahdath, the causality principle in the world of being, which is on page 113. This was written about a year ago. It's a study of the Kitab-i Ahdath that I undertook at the behest of the House of Justice, and it was first published in the most recent edition of the Baha'i World, except probably the most recent edition is coming out, the one that was published a year ago in May, okay, which I think is still the last one out, but there will be another one out soon if it's not already out. So, and it was reprinted then here integrally. And this contains a number of further reflections that are not in the concept of spirituality that I've talked about. Things about power and justice and love and so on. There's a series of three essays, none of which I've talked about here, called Prologue on Proving God, Causality, Composition, and the Origin of Existence, and a Scientific Proof of the Existence of God. The Prologue on Proving God was written for this book, so it has not previously appeared. A Causality, Composition, and the Origin of Existence is published here for the first time. It was not newly written. It was not written expressly for this book. I wrote it 2 or 3 years ago. In fact, it was the basis of a presentation I made a few years ago at a conference on science and theology at the Vatican. I have actually been looking for an outlet for this because it was rejected in several places that I submitted it for publication for various reasons. So I was happy to have the opportunity to publish it. For those of you who may have read another work that I published a few years ago called Logic and Logos, which was published by George Ronald, there's an article in there about Avicenna's proof of the existence of God. This Causality, Composition, the Origin, Existence is a sequel to that. It's essentially a sequel to that, but it is entirely self-contained. And then the Scientific Proof of the Existence of God was first published in the Journal of Baha'i Studies a couple of years ago, and there are still exchanges going on. There's still a series of reader commentaries and author responses going on in the current issues of the Journal of Baha'i Studies over this. So every aspect of this scientific proof has been scrutinized and criticized by various people, which is fine, that's why we publish them. You will notice if you look at the blurb on the back, we have two pre-publication blurbs, one from James F. Strange, professor of religious studies at the University of South Florida. This man is a Baptist theologian. He is not a Baha'i. He is, in fact, a Baptist theologian. And so he knows he's a colleague of my brother, who is professor at the University of South Florida. So we were fishing around for a pre-publication blurb from somebody. So my brother gave him the manuscript of all of the essays, and so sort of thinking, well, maybe, you know, he will be moved to write something. And so turns out he passed it around to all of his colleagues and everything, and he says, this is really new stuff. And in particular, he was impressed. He says, as you see, perhaps the most startling gem is a manifestation of the thesis of the book, in this case, a profound and rigorous scientific proof of the existence of God. This is essential reading for those standing at the interface of science and religion, or for those who would stand there in peace. So this is a validation from a non-Baha'i source, one which would normally be inclined to be critical of Baha'i sources because he is a committed Baptist theologian. But he told me, well, he said, I don't think this stuff has been done before. And then the other blurb is written by an author and lawyer, William C. Lane, very brilliant man, whom I met in St. Petersburg, but who's an American, who's writing a book which I hope he will finish. He's writing a book on, called The Case for God. He's a lawyer, remember. But he is, no, it's The Case for God.
Okay.
Yeah. And, but the guy is very knowledgeable. He writes extremely well. And so I was immediately extremely impressed with what this guy was doing. He's not a, he doesn't call himself a believer in God, much less a Baha'i, but he writes extremely well and is extremely perceptive. And so I sort of became the editor of his stuff. I mean, we hit it off, and so I started editing his stuff. And but this this relationship was interrupted when he went back to the States. But so I shot him the manuscript of this stuff and said, would he make a comment? And he did. He made a very nice comment. But also he said he read The Logic and Logos. And his specialty sort of is the whole thing of science and religion. And he said, stuff that you did 30 years ago is only now beginning to be done. He said, I know the literature in this area, and what you were doing 30 years ago, nobody was doing. Of course, I knew that. But what was always disappointing is that nobody else knew it, because either nobody read it or nobody seemed to understand it or whatever. So, who knows? Maybe it will be recognized as whatever, it's God's will, of course. But I mention this only to point out that, you know, whatever we do for the faith, we do for the intrinsic integrity of it, not for the reaction that it produces immediately. I mean, it's a gift that we give to our service, is a gift that we give to Baha'u'llah, and he does with it what he wills. And you know, one cannot know whether or not or to what extent something that we do will ultimately have an impact. Interestingly enough, all of the criticisms of the scientific proof of the existence of God, which you can read, I'll let you read that, have come from Baha'is, all the negative criticisms. I've gotten no negative criticisms from scientists. I presented this proof to the full Academy of Sciences in Kazan. I presented it at the University of Moscow. I presented it at the University of St. Petersburg. I presented it in all sorts of international forums. I've never had a scientist criticize it, but I've had hundreds of Baha'is criticize it.